Welcome to this Uvula audio presentation of the Confessions of St. Augustine. Book 9, Chapter 2. Knowing that you were watching me, I thought it best to retire quietly from the market where I sold the services of my tongue rather than make an abrupt and sensational departure. I intended that young pupils who gave no thought to your law or peace, but only to lies and the insane warfare of the courts, should no longer buy from my lips any weapon to arm their madness. Luckily, there were now only a few days left before the autumn holidays, and I decided to bear with this delay and withdraw at the proper time. Now that I had been redeemed by you, I had no intention of offering myself for sale again. This plan was known to you, but no man knew of it except our closest friends. We had agreed that it should not be made generally known, although as we climbed up from the Valley of Tears, singing the Song of Ascent, you had given us sharp arrows and burning coals to use against any cunning tongues that might speak against us, under the pretense of giving good advice, and devour us with their love, just as men devour food for which they have a liking. You had pierced our hearts with the arrows of your love, and we carried your words with us, as though they were staked to our living bodies. Ranged before our minds so that our thoughts were full of them, were the examples of your servants, whose darkness you had made light, and whose death you had changed to life. Their example fired us and banished our dull inertia, so that we turned no more to worldly things. It lit in us so strongly a flame that no cunning tongue could puff it out with the breath of antagonism, but only fanned it to a fiercer heat. But for the sake of your name, which you have made holy throughout the world, there would certainly be others to applaud our decision and our plans. Because of this, we thought it would seem like ostentation if, instead of waiting for the holidays, which were now so close at hand, I were to resign at once from the profession that I had practiced openly, and because of which I was a public figure. My action would attract the attention of everyone, and when they saw that I had chosen not to wait for the beginning of the holidays, although it was so close, many of them would say that it was because I wanted to win a fine reputation for myself. And what good would it have done me to have my motives discussed and debated, and to have allowed that which was a good thing for me to be brought into disrepute? Besides this, during the summer I had developed a weakness of the lungs, the result of too much study. I found breathing difficult and had pains in the chest that were symptomatic of lung trouble. My voice was husky, and I could not speak for long at a time. At first I had been worried because I had nearly been obliged to give up the strain of teaching altogether, or at least to take a rest from it in order to undergo treatment and regain my strength. But once the will to wait quietly and have proof that you are God had begun to grow in me, and then had become a firm resolution, "This you know, my God," I was even glad to have this genuine excuse with which I could appease indignant parents, who for the sake of their children would never have been willing to allow me my freedom. So with this thought to cheer me, I managed to endure to the end of this period of waiting. It was a little less than 3 weeks, as far as I can remember, when I needed all my powers of endurance, even to wait so short a time as this. I had lost the ambition to make money, which had always helped me to bear the strain of teaching. And if patience had not taken its place, I should have been left without a prop to prevent me from being crushed beneath the burden. Some of your servants, my brothers in faith, may say that it was sinful of me to allow myself to occupy the chair of lies, even for 1 hour, now that my heart was fully given to your service. I will not dispute that. But, O most merciful Lord, did you not forgive this sin and remit its guilt, as well as all my other horrible and deadly sins, in the holy water of baptism? 3. Verkundus was wearing himself out with worry over our newfound blessings. As he saw it, because of his own ties, which still bound him fast, he was deprived of our company. He was not yet a Christian, but it was his Christian wife who proved the strongest tie of all, and he was kept for the present from taking the course that we had set ourselves, because he had always said that he would not be a Christian, except in the very way that was not open to him. All the same, he kindly offered to allow us to stay in his country house for as long as we needed. You will surely repay him for his goodness, O Lord, when the just are given their reward, since you have already awarded him the lot of the just. For after our departure, when we were at Rome, he fell ill and died, but not before he had been received into the church on his sickbed. In this you had mercy not only on him, but also on us, for the memory of the extreme kindness that he showed us as our friend would have tormented us with unbearable sorrow if we had not known that he was one of your flock. We thank you for this, you who are God. We are yours. We know it from the charges you lay upon us and the consolations you give. You are faithful to your promises, and for his country house at Cassiciacum, where we found rest in you, far from the world and its troubles, you are repaying Verecundus with the contentment of your paradise, where nothing ever fades away. For in your mountain, your fruitful mountain, that is rich like butter, you have forgiven him his sins upon earth. But while Verecundus suffered these torments, Nebridius shared our joy. Before he was a Christian, he, like us, had been caught in the pitfall of the most deadly error, and had refused to believe in the reality of the truth incarnate, the body of your Son. But he had now struggled free, and although he had not yet received any of the sacraments of your church, he was most persistent in his search for truth. Not long after we had been converted and born again in your baptism, you freed him from this life. By then he too had become a faithful Catholic. He served you in perfect chastity and continence at home in Africa with his family. For through him his whole household had been made Christian. Now he lives in Abraham's bosom, and whatever may be the meaning of that bosom, there Nebridius lives, my very dear friend, taken by you to be your son, no longer simply one whom you had freed from bondage. There he lives, for what other place is there for a soul such as his? There he lives in that very place about which he used to question me so much, poor ignorant man that I was. He no longer lays his ear to my lips, but with the lips of his spirit, he drinks in wisdom at your fountain. He drinks till his thirst is slaked and his happiness is never ending. And I cannot believe that the draught intoxicates him so that he forgets me, for it is you, O Lord, whom he drinks in, and you are mindful of your servants. This was how matters stood with us. We consoled Verecundus in his sadness, not allowing our friendship with him to lapse because of our conversion, and urging him to remain faithful to the married state that was his lot. As for Nebridius, we waited for him to follow our lead, and this he might well have done, for he was very close to doing so. In fact, he was on the point of being converted when at long last my period of waiting came to an end. To me that time seemed to drag on day after day, because I was longing for respite and the freedom to give voice to the song that swelled up deep within me. True to my heart's promise, I have eyes only for you. I long, Lord, for your presence. 4. The day came when my release from the profession of rhetoric was to become a reality, just as in my mind I was free from it already. The deed was done, and you rescued my tongue, as you had already rescued my heart. Praising you and full of joy, I set out for the house in the country with all my friends and relations. Once we were there, I began at last to serve you with my pen. The books I wrote are evidence of this, although the old air can still be sensed in them, as though I were still panting from my exertions in the school of pride. In them I recorded the discussions I held with my friends who were with me, and my deliberations with myself when I was alone in your presence, and my correspondence with Nebridius, who was not with us, can still be read in my letters. But time could never suffice for me to set down on paper all the great blessings that you bestowed upon me, particularly in that time, since I must hurry on to tell you of greater things. For I remember the kind of man I was, O Lord, and it is a sweet task to confess how you tamed me by pricking my heart with your goad, how you bridged every valley, leveled every mountain and hill of my thoughts, how you cut straight their windings and pave their rough paths, and how you also brought Alypius, whom in my heart I regarded as a brother, to submit to the name of your only begotten Son, our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. At first he thought this unworthy of mention in my books, because he wanted them to carry the scholarly fragrance of the cedars of Lebanon that the Lord has now broken, rather than that of the herbs with which the church heals the bites of serpents. How I cried out to you, my God, when I read the Psalms of David, those hymns of faith, those songs of a pious heart in which the spirit of pride can find no place. I was new to your true love. I was a catechumen, living at leisure in that country house with Alypius, a catechumen like myself, and my mother, who never left us. She had the weak body of a woman, but the strong faith of a man, the composure of her years, a mother's love for her son, and the devotion of a Christian. How I cried out to you when I read those psalms, how they set me on fire with love of you. I was burning to echo them to all the world, if only I could, so that they might vanquish man's pride. And indeed they are sung throughout the world, and just as none can hide away from the sun, none can escape your burning heat. The thought of the Manichees filled me with angry resentment and bitter sorrow, and yet I pitied them too, because in their ignorance of the sacraments that heal us, they raved against the very remedy that could have cured them of their madness. I wished that they could have been somewhere at hand, unknown to me, to watch my face and hear my voice as I read the fourth psalm. They would have seen how deeply it moved me. When I call on your name, listen to me, O God, and grant me redress. Still, in time of trouble, you have brought me relief. Have pity on me now, and hear my prayer. How I wish they could have heard me speak those words, and how I wish I might have been unaware that they could hear, so that they need have no cause to think my own words that escaped from me as I recited the psalm were uttered for their benefit alone. And it is true enough that I would not have uttered them, or if I had, I should not have uttered them in the same way, if I had known that they were watching and listening. And if I had uttered them, the Manichees would not have understood them in the way that I spoke them. They would not have understood how this cry came from my inmost heart when I was alone in your presence. I quivered with fear, yet at the same time I was aglow with hope, rejoicing in your mercy, my Father. All these emotions were revealed in the light of my eyes and the tremor of my voice when I read the message of your Holy Spirit. Great ones of the world, will your hearts always be hardened? Will you never cease setting your heart on shadows and following a lie? For it was just this that I had done. But you, O Lord, had already raised your Holy Son to glory. You had raised him from the dead and bidden him to sit on your right hand, so that from his place at your side he might send us the one whom he promised, the Paraclete, the truth-giving Spirit. He had already sent the Paraclete, and I had not known it. He had already risen from the dead and ascended into heaven. He had already been raised to glory, and because of this he had sent the Paraclete. The Spirit had not yet been given to men, because Jesus had not yet been raised to glory. But the words of the prophet are loud in our ears. Will your hearts always be hardened? Will you never cease setting your heart on shadows and following a lie? Be sure of this, that the Lord has raised his Holy Son to glory. The words are loud in our ears. Will your hearts be always hardened? Be sure. And yet, for so long I had not known their meaning. I had set my heart on shadows and followed a lie. And this was why I was frightened when I heard these words, because I remembered that I had been just such a man as those to whom they are spoken. For there had been shadows and lies in the phantasms that I had taken for the truth, and the memory of my past wrung many loud cries of sorrow from my lips. How I wished that my cries could have been heard by those who still set their hearts on shadows and followed lies. Perhaps they would have been made to feel the error of their ways and would have disgorged it like vomit. And you would have heard them when they cried out to you, For Christ, who pleads with you for us, truly died for us in the flesh. I read on, "Tremble and sin no more." And this moved me deeply, my God, because by now I had learnt to tremble for my past, so that in the future I might sin no more. And it was right that I should tremble, because it was not some other nature belonging to the tribe of darkness that had sinned in me, as the Manichees pretend. They do not tremble, but they store up retribution for themselves against the day of retribution, when God will reveal the justice of his judgments. The good which I now brought was not outside myself. I did not look for it in things that are seen with the eye of the flesh by the light of the sun. For those who try to find joy in things outside themselves easily vanish away into emptiness. They waste themselves on the temporal pleasures of the visible world. Their minds are starved, and they nibble at empty shadows. How I wish they would tire of going hungry and cry out for a sight of better times. This is the answer they would hear from us. Already, Lord, the sunshine of your favor has been plainly shown to us, for we are not ourselves the light that enlightens every soul. We are enlightened by you, so that we who were once all darkness may now, in the Lord, be all daylight. How I wish that they could see the eternal light within us. Now that I had glimpsed it myself, I fretted and chafed because I could not make them see it. For if they had come to me and cried out for a sight of better times, I should have seen that their hearts looked out through their eyes on the world outside, away from you. But it was in my inmost heart, where I had grown angry with myself, where I had been stung with remorse, where I had slain my old self and offered it in sacrifice, where I had first purposed to renew my life and had placed my hope in you. It was there that you had begun to make me love you and had made me glad at heart. It was my eyes that read these words, but my soul that knew their meaning. They brought a cry to my lips, and I wished no more for the manifold riches of this earth, things on which I should lose time, only to be lost in time myself. For in eternity, which is one alone, I had other corn and wine and oil. When I read the next verse, a loud cry broke from my heart. In peace and friendliness I will sleep. I will take my rest in the eternal God. Oh, the joy of these words! For when the saying of Scripture comes true, and death is swallowed up in victory, who shall withstand us? You truly are the eternal God, because in you there is no change, and in you we find the rest that banishes all our labor. For there is no other besides you, and we need not struggle for other things that are not of you. And it was you, O Lord, who bade me repose in confidence unprotected. I read the psalm, and there was fire in my heart, but I could think of no means of helping those deaf corpses, of whom I had myself been one. For I had been evil as the plague. Like a cur I had snarled blindly and bitterly against the Scriptures, that are sweet with the honey of heaven and radiant with your light. And now I was sick at heart over the rebellion of those who hate them. When shall I set down the record of those days of rest? One thing at least I shall not fail to tell, for I have not forgotten the sting of your lash, nor how quickly your mercy came, and in how wonderful a way. During that vacation you let me suffer the agony of toothache, and when the pain became so great that I could not speak, my heart prompted me to ask all my friends who were with me to pray to you for me, since you are the God who gives health to the body as well as the soul. I wrote down the message and gave it to them to read, and as soon as we knelt down to offer you this humble prayer, the pain vanished. And what was that pain? And how did it vanish? My Lord and God, I confess that I was terrified, for nothing like this had ever happened to me in all my life. Deep within me I recognized the working of your will, and I praised your name, rejoicing in my faith. But my faith would not let me feel at ease over my past sins, for they had not yet been forgiven in your baptism.
5. When the autumn vacation was over,
I notify the people of Milan that they must find another vendor of words for their students. Because I had chosen to be your servant, and also because of the difficulty I had in breathing and the pain in my lungs, made me unfit for the duties of a professor. I wrote to your bishop, the saintly Ambrose, to tell him of my past errors and the purpose I now had in mind. I asked him to advise me which books of Scripture it would be best for me to study, so that I might be better prepared and more fit to receive so good a grace. He told me to read the prophet Isaiah, presumably because the gospel and calling of the Gentiles are foretold more clearly in that book than any other. But I didn't understand the first chapters, and on the assumption that the rest of the book would be equally difficult, I laid it aside to be taken up again later, when I should be more used to the style in which God's words are spoken. 6. When the time came for me to hand in my name for baptism, we left the country and went back to Milan. It was Alypius's wish to be reborn in you at the same time. He was already imbued with the humility that fits a man for your sacraments, and he had subjected his body to such stern discipline that he would even walk barefoot on the icy soil of Italy, a thing that few of us would venture to do. With us we took the boy Adiodatus, my natural son born of my sin. You had given him every gift. Although he was barely 15, there were many learned and respected men who were not his equals in intelligence. I acknowledge that he had his gifts from you, O Lord my God, who are the creator of all, and have great power to reshape our deformities, for there was nothing of mine in that boy except my sin. It was you too and none other who had inspired us to bring him up as you would have him. These were your gifts, and I acknowledge them. There is a book of mine called De Magistro, which consists of a dialogue between Adiodatus and myself. You know that all the ideas expressed by the second speaker in the discussion are his, although he was only 16 when it took place, and I learned for myself that he had many other talents even more remarkable than this. His intelligence left me spellbound, and who but you could work such wonders? But you took him from this world early in life, and now I remember him without apprehension, for there was nothing in his childhood or his youth or in any part of his life that need make me fear for him. We made him our companion, in your grace no younger than ourselves. Together we were ready to begin our schooling in your ways. We were baptized, and all our anxiety over the past melted away from us. The days were all too short, for I was lost in wonder and joy, meditating upon your far-reaching providence for the salvation of the human race. The tears flowed from me when I heard your hymns and canticles, for the sweet singing of your church moved me deeply. The music surged in my ears, truth seeped into my heart, and my feelings of devotion overflowed, so that the tears streamed down. But they were tears of gladness. 7. It was not long before this that the church at Milan had begun to seek comfort and spiritual strength in the practice of singing hymns, in which the faithful united fervently with heart and voice. It was only a year, or not much more, since Justina, the mother of the boy Emperor Valentinian, had been persecuting your devoted servant Ambrose in the interests of the heresy into which the Arians had seduced her. In those days your faithful people used to keep watch in the church, ready to die with their bishop, your servant. My mother, your handmaid, was there with him, taking a lead part in that anxious time of vigilance and living a life of constant prayer. Although I was not yet fired by the warmth of your spirit, these were stirring times for me as well, for the city was in a state of alarm and excitement. It was then that the practice of singing hymns and psalms was introduced, in keeping with the usage of the Eastern churches, to revive the flagging spirits of the people during their long and cheerless watch. Ever since then the custom has been retained, and the example of Milan has been followed in many other places, in fact, in almost every church throughout the world. It was at that time, too, that you revealed to your bishop Ambrose, in a vision, the place where the bodies of the martyrs Protaceous, and Gervasius were hidden. All these years you had preserved them incorrupt in your secret treasury, so that when the time came you could bring them to light to thwart the fury of a woman, a mere woman but one who ruled an empire. For after the bodies had been discovered and dug up, they were carried to Ambrose's basilica with the honor that was due to them. On the way, several persons who were tormented by evil spirits were cured, for even the devils acknowledged the holy relics. But this was not all. There was also a man who had been blind for many years, a well-known figure in the city. He asked why the crowd was running wild with joy, and when they told him the reason, he leapt to his feet and begged his guide to lead him to where the bodies lay. When he reached the place, he asked to be allowed to touch the bier with his handkerchief, for it was the bier of your saints, whose death is dear in your sight. No sooner had he done this and put the handkerchief to his eyes than his sight was restored. The news spread. Your praises rang out loud and clear, and although this miracle did not convert the mind of your enemy, Justina, to sound beliefs, at least it restrained her from the madness of persecution. Thanks be to you, O God. Why have you prompted my memory so that I should confess to you these great events that I had forgotten to mention? Yet even then, when the fragrance of your perfumes allured, I did not hasten after you. So I wept all the more when I heard your hymns and holy songs, for it was as though after I had so long sighed for your fragrance, I could at last breathe it in, at least in so far as human frailty can perceive it. 8. You, O God, who bring men of one mind to live together, brought a young man from our own town, named Evodius, to join our company. He had been converted and baptized before us, while he was employed as a government officer, but he had given up the service of the state and entered upon yours. He remained with us, and we intended to live together in the devout life that we proposed to lead. We discussed where we could most usefully serve you, and together we set out to return to Africa. While we were at Ostia, at the mouth of the Tiber, my mother died. There are many things that I do not set down in this book, since I am pressed for time, my God, but I pray that you accept my confessions and also the gratitude I bear you for all the many things that I pass over in silence. I will not omit a word that my mind can bring to birth concerning your servant, my mother, however. In the flesh she brought me to birth in this world. In her heart she brought me to birth in your eternal light. It is not of her gifts that I shall speak, but of the gifts you gave to her. For she was neither her own maker nor her own teacher. It was you who made her, and neither her father nor her mother knew what kind of woman their daughter would grow up to be. It was by Christ's teaching, by the guidance of your only Son, that she was brought up to honor and obey you in one of those good Christian families that form the body of your church. Yet she always said that her good upbringing had not been due so much to the attentiveness of her mother as to the care of an aged servant who had carried my grandfather on her back when he was a baby, as older girls do with small children. Her master and mistress, out of the gratitude for her long service and respect for her great age and exceptional character, treated her as an honored member of their Christian household. This was why they placed their daughters in her care. She was conscientious in attending to her duties, correcting the children when necessary with strictness, for the love of God, and teaching them to lead wise and sober lives. Except at the times when they ate their frugal meals at their parents' table, she would not allow them to drink even water, however great their thirst, for fear that they might develop bad habits. She used to give them this very good advice. Now you drink water because you are not allowed to have wine, but when you are married and have charge of your own larders and cellars, you will not be satisfied with water, but the habit of drinking will be too strong for you. By making rules of this sort and using her influence, she was able to keep the natural greediness of childhood within bounds and teach the girls to control their thirst as they ought so that they no longer wanted what it was not correct for them to have. Yet in spite of this, as your servant and my mother used to tell me herself, she developed a secret liking for wine. Her parents, believing her to be a good and obedient child, used to send her to draw wine from the cask, as was the custom. She used to dip the cup through the opening at the top of the barrel, and before pouring the wine into the flagon, she would sip a few drops, barely touching it with her lips, but no more than this, because she found the taste disagreeable. She did this not because she had any relish for the liquor and its effects, but simply from the exuberant high spirits of childhood, which find their outlet in playful escapades and are generally kept in check by the authority of older people. Each day she added a few more drops to her daily sip of wine. But little things despise, and little by little you shall come to ruin. It soon became a habit, and she would drink her wine at a draught, almost by the cupful. Where, then, was this wise old woman? What use were her strict prohibitions? Could there have been any remedy for this secret disease, except your healing power, O Lord, that watches over us always? Even when our fathers and mothers and those who have charge of us in childhood are not with us, you are there. You who created us, you who call us to come to you, you who also use those who are placed over us to help us save our souls. What did you do then, my God? How did you look after my mother and cure her disease? Was it not you who, from another soul, brought harsh words of rebuke, as though the sharp taunt were a surgeon's knife drawn from your secret store, with which you cut away the gangrene at one stroke? For my mother used to go to the cellar with a servant girl. One day when they were alone, this girl quarreled with her young mistress, as servants do, and intending it as a most bitter insult, called my mother a drunkard. The word struck home. My mother realized how despicable her fault had been, and at once condemned it and renounced it. Our enemies can often correct our faults by their disparagement, just as the flattery of friends can corrupt us. But you, O Lord, reward them, not according to the ends that you achieve by using them, but according to the purpose that they have in mind. For the girl had lost her temper and wanted to provoke her young mistress, not to correct her. She did it when they were alone, either because the quarrel happened to take place at a time when no one else was present, or because she may have been afraid of being punished for not having mentioned the matter earlier. But you, O Lord, ruler of all things in heaven and on earth, who make the deep river serve your purposes and govern the raging tides of time as it sweeps on, you even use the anger of one soul to cure the folly of another. Let this be a warning, so that none of us may ascribe it to our own doing, if we find that others, whose ways we wish to see reformed, are corrected by the words we speak. 9. In this way my mother was brought up in modesty and temperance. It was you who taught her to obey her parents rather than they who taught her to obey you. And when she was old enough, they gave her in marriage to a man whom she served as her lord. She never ceased to try to gain him for you as a convert, for the virtues with which you had adorned her, and for which he respected, loved, and admired her, were like so many voices constantly speaking to him of you. He was unfaithful to her, but her patience was so great that his infidelity never became a cause of quarreling between them. For she looked to you to show him mercy, hoping that chastity would come with faith. Though he was remarkably kind, he had a hot temper, but my mother knew better than to say or do anything to resist him when he was angry. If his anger was unreasonable, she used to wait until he was calm and composed, and then took the opportunity of explaining what she had done. Many women whose faces were disfigured by blows from husbands far sweeter tempered than her own used to gossip and complain of the behavior of their menfolk. My mother would meet this complaint with another about the women's tongues. Her manner was light, but her meaning serious when she told them that ever since they had heard the marriage deed read over them, that they ought to have regarded it as a contract that bound them to serve their husbands, and from that time onward they should remember their condition and not defy their masters. These women knew well enough how hot-tempered a husband my mother had to cope with. They used to remark how surprising it was that they had never heard or seen any marks to show that Patricius had beaten his wife or that there had been any domestic disagreement between them, even for one day. When they asked her, as friends, to tell them the reason, she used to explain the rule that I have mentioned. Those who accepted it found it a good one. The others continued to suffer humiliation and cruelty. Her mother-in-law was at first prejudiced against her by the tale-bearing of malicious servants, but she won the older woman over by her dutiful attentions and her constant patience and gentleness. In the end, her mother-in-law complained of her own accord to her son and asked him to punish the servants for their meddlesome talk that was the spoiling of peaceful domestic relations between herself and her daughter-in-law. Patricius, who was anxious to satisfy his mother as well as to preserve the good order of his home and the peace of his family, took the names of the offenders from his mother and had them whipped as she desired. She then warned them that anyone who told tales about her daughter-in-law in the hope of pleasing her could expect to receive the same treatment. After this, none of them dared to tell tales, and the two women lived together in wonderful harmony and mutual goodwill. There was another great gift which you had given to your good servant in whose womb you created me, O God, my mercy. Whenever she could, she used to act the part of the peacemaker between souls in conflict over some quarrel. When misunderstanding is rife and hatred raw and undigested, it often gives a vent in the presence of a friend to spite against an absent enemy. But if one woman launched a bitter tirade against another in my mother's hearing, she never repeated to either what the other had said, except for such things as were likely to reconcile them. I should not regard this as especially virtuous, were it not for the fact that I know from bitter experience that a great many people, infected by this sin, as though it were some horrible widespread contagion, not only report to one disputant what the other has said, but even add words that were never spoken. And yet a man who loves his own kind ought not to be satisfied merely to refrain from exciting or increasing enmity between other men by the evil that he speaks. He should do his best to put an end to their quarrels by kind words. This was my mother's way, learned in the school of her heart, where you were her secret teacher. In the end, she won her husband for you as a convert in the very last days of his life on earth. After his conversion, she no longer had to grieve over those faults that had tried her patience before he was a Christian. She was also the servant of your servants. Those of them who knew her praised you, honored you, and loved you in her, for they could feel your presence in her heart, and her holy conversation gave rich proof of it. She had been faithful to one husband, had made due returns to those who gave her birth. Her own flesh and blood had had first claim on her piety, and she had a name for acts of charity. She had brought up her children and had been in travail afresh each time she saw them go astray from you. Finally, O Lord, since by your gift you allow us to speak as your servants, she took good care of all of us when we had received the grace of your baptism and were living as companions before she fell asleep in you. She took good care of us as though she had been the mother of us all, and served each one as though she had been his daughter. 10. Not long before the day on which she was to leave this life, my mother and I were alone, leaning from a window that overlooked the garden and the courtyard of the house where we were staying at Ostia. We were waiting there after our long and tiring journey away from the crowd to refresh ourselves before our sea voyage. I believe that what I am going to tell happened through the secret working of your providence, for we were talking alone and our conversation was serene and joyful. We had forgotten what we had left behind and were intent on what lay before us. In the presence of truth, which is yourself, we were wondering what the eternal life of the saints would be like, that life which no eye has seen, no ear has heard, no human heart conceived. But we laid the lips of our hearts to the heavenly stream that flows from your fountain, the source of all life that is in you, so that as far as it was in our power to do so, we might be sprinkled with its waters and in some sense reach an understanding of this great mystery. Our conversation led us to the conclusion that no bodily pleasure, however great it might be, and whatever earthly light might shed luster upon it, was worthy of comparison, or even mention, beside the happiness of the life of the saints. As the flame of love burned stronger in us and raised us higher toward the eternal God, our thoughts ranged over the whole compass of material things in their various degrees, up to the heavens themselves, from which the sun and the moon and the stars shine down upon the earth. Higher still we climbed, thinking and speaking all the while, in wonder at all that you have made. At length we came to our own souls, and passed beyond them to that place of everlasting plenty, where you feed Israel forever with the food of truth. There life is that wisdom by which all these things that we know are made, all things that ever have been, and all that are yet to be. But that wisdom is not made. It is as it has always been, and as it will be forever. Or rather, I should not say that it has been or will be, for it simply is, because eternity is not in the past or future. And while we spoke of the eternal wisdom, longing for it and straining for it with all the strength of our hearts, for one fleeting instant we reached out and touched it. And then with a sigh, leaving our spiritual harvest bound to it, we returned to the sound of our own speech, in which each word has a beginning and an ending. Far, far different from your word, O Lord, who abides in himself forever, yet never grows old and gives new life to all things. And so our discussion went on. Suppose we said that the tumult of a man's flesh were to cease, and all that his thoughts can conceive of earth, of water, and of air should no longer speak to him. Suppose that the heavens and even his own soul were silent, no longer thinking of itself, but passing beyond. Suppose that his dreams and the visions of his imagination spoke no more, and that every tongue and every sign and all that is transient grew silent. For all these things have the same message to tell, if only we can hear it. And their message is this: we did not make ourselves, but he who abides forever made us. Suppose we said that after giving us this message and bidding us to listen to him who made them, they fell silent, and he alone should speak to us, not through them, but in his own voice, so that we should hear him speaking, not by any tongue of the flesh, or by an angel's voice, not in the sound of thunder or in some veiled parable, but in his own voice, the voice of the one whom we love in all these created things. Suppose that we heard him himself, with none of these things between ourselves and him. Just as in that brief moment my mother and I had reached out in thought and touched the eternal wisdom that abides over all things, suppose that this state were to continue, and all other visions of things inferior were to be removed, so that this single vision entranced and absorbed the one who beheld it, and enveloped him in inward joys in such a way that for him life was eternally the same as that instant of understanding for which we had longed so much. Would not this be what we are to understand by the words, "Come and share the joy of your Lord"? But when is it to be? Is it to be when we all rise again, but not all of us will undergo the change? This was the point of our talk, though we did not speak in these precise words or exactly as I have reported them. Yet you know, O Lord, that as we talked that day, the world, for all its pleasures, seemed a paltry place compared with the life that we spoke of. And then my mother said, "My son, for my part, I find no further pleasure in this life. What I am still to do, or why I am here in this world, I do not know, for I have no more to hope for on this earth. There was one reason, and one reason alone, why I wished to remain a little longer in this life, and that was to see you, a Catholic Christian, before I died. God has granted me my wish, and more besides, for now I see you as his servant, spurning such happiness as the world can give. What is left for me to do in this world?" 11. I scarcely remember what answer I gave her. It was about 5 days after this, or not much more, that she took to her bed with a fever. One day during her illness, she had a fainting fit and lost consciousness for a short time. We hurried to her bedside, but she soon regained consciousness and looked up at my brother and me as we stood beside her. With a puzzled look, she asked, "Where was I?" Then, watching us closely, as we stood there speechless with grief, she said, "You will bury your mother here." I said nothing, trying hard to hold back my tears, but my brother said something to the effect that he wished for her sake that she would die in her own country and not abroad. When she heard this, she looked at him anxiously, and her eyes reproached him for his worldly thoughts. She turned to me and said, "See how he talks?" And then, speaking to both of us, she went on, "It does not matter where you bury my body. Don't let that worry you. All I ask of you is that, wherever you may be, you should remember me at the altar of the Lord." Although she hardly had the strength to speak, she managed to make us understand her wishes and then fell silent, for her illness was becoming worse and she was in great pain. "But I was thinking of your gifts, O God. Unseen by us, you plant them like seeds in the hearts of your faithful, and they grow to bear wonderful fruits." This thought filled me with joy, and I thanked you for your gifts, for I had always known, and well remembered now, my mother's great anxiety to be buried beside her husband's body in the grave that she had provided and prepared for herself. Because they had lived in the greatest harmony, she had always wanted this extra harmony. She had wanted it to be said of them that, after her journeyings across the sea, it had been granted to her that the earthly remains of husband and wife should be joined as one and covered by the same earth. How little the human mind can understand God's purpose! I did not know when it was that your good gifts had borne their full fruit, and her heart had begun to renounce this vain desire. But I was both surprised and pleased to find that it was so. And yet, when we talked at the window and she asked, "What is left for me to do in this world?" it was clear she had no desire to die in her own country. Afterwards, I also heard that one day during our stay at Ostia, when I was absent, she had talked in a motherly way to some of my friends, and had spoken to them of the contempt of this life and the blessings of death. They were astonished to find such courage in a woman. "It was your gift to her, O Lord," and they asked whether she was not frightened at the thought of leaving her body so far from her own country. She replied, "Nothing is far from God, and I have no fear that he will not know where to find me when he comes to raise me to life at the end of this world." So on the 9th day of her illness, when she was 56 and I was 33, her pious and devoted soul was set free from her body. 12. I closed her eyes and a great wave of sorrow surged into my heart. It would have overflowed in tears if I had not made a strong effort of will and stemmed the flow, so that the tears dried in my eyes. What a terrible struggle it was to hold them back. As she breathed her last, Adeodatus began to wail aloud, and only ceased his cries when we all checked him. I too felt that I wanted to cry like a child, but a more mature voice within me, the voice of my heart, bid me keep my sobs in check, and I remained silent. For we did not think it right to mark my mother's death with weeping and moaning, because such lamentations are the usual accompaniment of death when it is thought of as a state of misery or as total extinction. But she had not died in misery, nor had she wholly died. Of this we were certain, both because we knew what a holy life she had led, and also because our faith was real, and we had sure reasons not to doubt it. What was it, then, that caused me such deep sorrow? It can only have been because the wound was fresh, the wound I had received when our life together, which had been so precious and dear to me, was suddenly cut off. I found comfort in the memory that, as I did what I could for my mother in the last stages of her illness,
She had caressed me and said I was a good son to her. With great emotion, she told me she could not remember ever having heard me speak a single hard or disrespectful word against her. And yet, O God, who made us both, how could there be any comparison between the honor that I showed to her and the devoted service she had given me? It was now because I was bereft of all the comfort I had had from her that my soul was wounded and my life seemed shattered. For her life and mine had been as one. When we had succeeded in quieting Adeodatus, Evodius took up a psaltery and began to sing the psalm of mercy and justice, my song shall be, a psalm in thy honor, Lord. And the whole house sang the responses. On hearing what was happening, many of our brothers in the faith and many pious women came to us. And while those whose duty it was made arrangements for the funeral, I remained in another room where I could talk without irreverence and conversed with friends on matters suitable to the occasion, for they did not think it right to leave me by myself. These words of truth were the salve with which I soothed my pain. You knew, O Lord, how I suffered, but my friends did not, and as they listened intently to my words, they thought I had no sense of grief. But in your ears, where none of them could hear, I blamed myself for my tender feelings. I fought against the wave of sorrow, and for a while it receded, but then it swept upon me again with full force. It did not bring me to tears, and no sign of it showed in my face, but I knew well enough what I was stifling in my heart. It was misery to feel myself so weak a victim of these human emotions. Although we cannot escape them, since they are the natural lot of mankind, and so I had added the sorrow of being grieved by my own feelings, so that I was tormented by a twofold agony. When the body was carried out for burial, I went and returned without a tear. I did not weep even during the prayers that we recited while the sacrifice of our redemption was offered for my mother, and her body rested by the grave before it was laid in the earth, as is the custom there. Yet all that day I was secretly weighed down with grief. With all my heart I begged you to heal my sorrow, but you did not grant my prayer. I believe that this was because you wished to impress upon my memory, if only by this one lesson, how firmly the mind is gripped in the bonds of habit, even when it is nourished on the word of truth. I thought I would go to the baths because I had been told that the Latin name for them was derived from the Greek, so-called because bathing rids the mind of anxiety. And I acknowledge your mercy in this too, O Father of orphans, for I went to the baths and came back in the same state as before. Water could not wash away the bitter grief from my heart. Then I went to sleep and woke up to find that the rest had brought me some relief from my sorrow. As I lay alone in bed, I remembered the verses of your servant Ambrose, and realized the truth in them. Deus creator omnium, polique rector vestiens, diem decora lumine, noctum supora gratiae, artus solutus utquies, redat laboras usui, mentesque fessas alevet, luctusque solvat anxio. Maker of all things, God Most High, great ruler of the starry sky, who, robing day with beauteous light, hast clothed in soft repose the night, that sleep may wearied limbs restore, and fit for toil use once more, may gently soothe the careworn breast, and lull our anxious griefs to rest. Little by little my old feelings about your handmaid came back to me. I thought of her devoted love for you and the tenderness and patience she had shown to me, like the holy woman that she was. Of all this I found myself suddenly deprived, and it was a comfort to me to weep for her and for myself and to offer my tears to you for her sake and mine. The tears that I had been holding back streamed down and I let them flow as freely as they would, making of them a pillow for my heart. On them it rested, for my weeping sounded in your ears alone, not in the ears of men who might have misconstrued it and despised it. And now, O Lord, I make my confession in this book. Let any man read it who will. Let him understand it as he will. And if he finds that I sinned by weeping for my mother, even if only for a fraction of an hour, let him not mock me. For this was the mother, now dead and hidden a while from my sight, who had wept over me for many years, so that I might live in your sight. Let him not mock at me, but weep himself, if his charity is great. Let him weep for my sins to you, the Father of all the brothers of your Christ. 13. Now that my soul has recovered from that wound in which perhaps I was guilty of too much worldly affection, tears of another sort stream from my eyes. They are tears that I offer to you, my God, for your handmaid. They flow from a spirit that trembles at the thought of the dangers that await every soul that has died with Adam. For although she was alive in Christ even before her soul was parted from the body, and her faith and the good life she led resounded to the glory of your name, yet I cannot presume to say that from the time when she was reborn in baptism, no word contrary to your commandments ever fell from her lips. Your Son, the truth, has said, any man who says to his brother, you fool, must answer for it in hell fire. And however praiseworthy a man's life may be, it will go hard with him if you lay aside your mercy when you come to examine it. But do not search out our faults ruthlessly. And because of this we hope and believe that one day we shall find a place with you. Yet if any man makes a list of his deserts, what would it be but a list of your gifts? If only men would know themselves for what they are. If only they who boast would make their boast in the Lord. And so, my glory and my life, God of my heart, I will lay aside for a while all the good deeds which my mother did. For them I thank you, but now I pray to you for her sins. Hear me through your Son, who hung on the cross and now sits at your right hand and pleads for us, for he is the true medicine of our wounds. I know that my mother always acted with mercy, and that she forgave others with all her heart when they trespassed against her. Forgive her too, O Lord, if ever she trespassed against you in all the long years of her life after baptism. Forgive her, I beseech you. Do not call her to account. Let your mercy give your judgment an honorable welcome, for your words are true, and you have promised mercy to the merciful. If they are merciful, it is by your gift, and you will show pity on those whom you pity. You will show mercy where you are merciful. I believe that you have already done what I asked of you, but, Lord, accept these vows of mine. For on the day when she was so soon to be released from the flesh, she had no care whether her body was to be buried in a rich shroud or embalmed with spices, nor did she wish to have a special monument or a grave in her own country. These were not the last wishes she passed on to us. All she wanted was that we should remember her at your altar, where she had been your servant day after day without fail. For she knew that at your altar we received the holy victim, who cancelled the decree made to our prejudice, and in whom we have triumphed over the enemy who reckons up our sins, trying to find some charge to bring against us, yet can find no fault in him in whom we conquer. Who shall restore to him his innocent blood? Who shall take us from him by repaying him the price for which he bought us? By the strong ties of faith, your handmaid had bound her soul to the sacrament of our redemption. Let no one tear her away from your protection. Let not the devil, who is lion and serpent in one, bar her way by force or by guile, for she will not answer that she has no debt to pay, for fear that her cunning accuser should prove her wrong and win her for himself. Her reply will be that her debt has been paid by Christ, to whom none can repay the price which he paid for us, though the debt was not his to pay. Let her rest in peace with her husband. He was her first husband, and she married no other after him. She served him, yielding you a harvest, so that in the end she also won him for you. O my Lord, my God, inspire your servants, my brothers. They are your sons, my masters, whom I serve with heart and voice and pen. Inspire those of them who read this book to remember Monica, your servant, at your altar, and with her Patricius, her husband who died before her, by whose bodies you brought me into this life, though how it was I do not know. With pious hearts let them remember those who were not only my parents in this light that fails, but were also my brother and sister, subject to you, our Father, in our Catholic Mother, the Church, and will be my fellow citizens in the eternal Jerusalem, for which your people sigh throughout their pilgrimage, from the time when they set out until the time when they return to you. So it shall be that the last request that my mother made to me shall be granted in the prayers of many who read my confessions more fully than in mine alone. End of Book 9.